It was Gandhi who famously said, "Be the change you wish to see in the world." It may sound simple, but changing hearts and minds is hard work. As anyone who's ever stood on a picket line or campaigned door to door or tried to mobilize on behalf of anything can attest. Ray Johnson is a somatic movement therapist and author of Embodied Activism. Some years ago, they got concerned about the high levels of burnout among social and political activists. There were people everywhere trying to make the world a better place, but getting discouraged and depressed. Ray says the process of making change is more sustainable when you listen to your body.
I was at a conference a number of years ago now, and I'd given a talk, and after the talk, there was a reception. And I was immediately waved over by two people who I recognized were sort of senior folks in the field, two men, both quite tall. I walk over to them, they say, "Hello, we listened to your talk." And they immediately begin peppering me with questions. Kind of challenging questions, but I understood where they were coming from. They were good questions. They weren't trying, I don't think, consciously to intimidate me. But what was happening on a body level, because they were so much taller than I was, they started to sort of lean in toward me and tower over me, and I felt intimidated. Mm. I'm not suggesting that talking to people at a conference is a traumatic event, but that our bodies respond to threat in some fairly typical ways. And I could feel these impulses happening in me, and I thought, I don't want to flee. I don't want to collapse. I don't want to just sort of stop answering questions and start nodding and agreeing with them and appeasing them. So I let my body do what it had the impulse to do. And what I did was I leaned in and I looked up at them and I beamed. I showed them with every fiber of my being that I was delighted to be in this interaction with them. But I leaned into their space. And what happened over the next moment or two was they looked a little startled and then they backed up. Huh. And the tone of the conversation shifted. The questions stopped coming so quickly. They slowed down. Somebody cracked a joke. And the whole tenor shifted profoundly.
Is this what you call somatic bandwidth?
Yes, it is. It's cultivating our sensuality. I don't mean that with any sexual overtones at all. I mean just tapping into all of the ways our bodies are wired to align with and attune to pleasure.
So, this new book you've written about embodied activism, I think that often we think of activism as starting with changing people's minds. It's about ideas and words.
Yes.
And you're suggesting that we have it backwards and we should start by thinking about the body. So why?
Well, part of the reason I wrote this book is that I'm living in the same moment in time as you are, and as we all are, particularly in the West, but I would say that this is now global, the increasing polarization of political discourse, intolerance, I think has really come to the forefront in a way that is creating in lots of people who are actually good-hearted, well-meaning, conscientious folks, this sense of of despair, of feeling as though there's nothing that they can do that's going to make a difference. That activism and social change work has been stereotyped as this thing that only certain people do, and you have to be organized, and you have to be a radical, and everyday folks don't have a place in that, or don't feel as though they have a place in it. And so we need to reframe what we think of when we think about activism and social change work. in a way that actually pays more attention to the little everyday interactions that we have with other people.
It's working, I was going to say, from the bottom up, but it's really from the inside out.
It's both. It's both from the inside out and from the bottom up. Other people have said it more eloquently than I have, and I'm going to paraphrase Augusto Boal, who was someone who developed a modality called theater of the oppressed. And he said this marvelous thing about how social dynamics and power structures are embedded in our everyday. They're all visible and embedded in our smallest everyday interactions with one another. And that happens between me and my dentist, not just between me and the government.
You know, it's funny, when I think of activism, I think of bodies in the streets.
Yes.
Marches, vigils, rallies, going door to door, you know, movement, real movement builds movements for change. Mm-hmm. But I think that what you mean when you talk about embodied activism is something much subtler.
Yeah.
So let's take another example. Here's a very, very everyday example. Anywhere in the political spectrum, there's plenty to be outraged about on a daily basis. You scan the news headlines, you see something some politician has done or said, somebody you disagree with violently, you can feel your whole body tense up, you feel angry.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do with that?
Yeah, that's such a good question. How we respond to our rage has a lot to do with our own histories. I think maybe when I say it, it'll be obvious, but I don't know that we necessarily pay much attention to the fact that anger is not inherently violent. Anger and violence travel together, but anger is a feeling. Violence is an action. So when I'm socialized, both in my own family setting or cultural settings, but also through the media, socialized to associate the experience of anger in my body with violent action, anger can get really scary. Many folks who espouse anti-violence can start to be anti-anger, when in fact, I think anger is an incredibly important emotion to have because it tells us something about the situation that we're in.
Yeah.
Learning how to use our anger rather than be overtaken by it means that in that moment where I'm reading the headline and I'm going, oh, I take a pause and I go, okay, what feels right for me in this moment to do with this feeling that I'm having? I might go for a walk and burn it off. I know lots of people who dance, like put on really loud, you know, kind of headbanging music and just stomp it out.
It's like banishing demons.
Exactly. It releases that charge so that we're not walking around with it in our bodies all day, sitting on it.
It seems to me that the real challenge of what you're saying, and also maybe the fun of it, is learning to cultivate an equal amount of awareness for what's pleasurable. And isn't it interesting that we don't do that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, to tap into how we're feeling in our bodies, how we feel in movement, like walking down the street, just the sensation of moving, the sensory capacities that we have of sight and hearing and sound and smell and taste. We use them all the time, but I don't know that we enjoy them.
Well, we're a puritanical culture, so I guess everything else is about work.
Yes.
Or striving or toil or something difficult.
This is a philosophical, political, social legacy that has really consistently vilified the body across so many arenas.
So in your book, you introduce a concept I hadn't heard before that I'm fascinated by, embodied microaggressions. So we all know what microaggressions are, but an embodied microaggression, what do you mean?
Well, upwards of 75% of the meaning of all of our communication with one another actually happens on the nonverbal level. Much of the work that had been done around microaggressions focused on what people said to one another that felt like a slight or an insult or a slur. Mm-hmm. And what I'm arguing is that we also need to pay attention to things like eye contact or lack of eye contact or the shrug of a shoulder or a slight turning away, moving back or moving forward. When we experience an embodied microaggression, we sometimes feel awful about ourselves and we don't know why. And many folks have gotten very good at conveying a whole lot of implicit bias, a whole lot of negative implicit bias, but keeping their words very politically correct.
So as a white cisgender woman, there are probably many ways I express unconscious bias and privilege physically and somatically. What could I be more aware of?
Leaning in. Really looking at someone, really like looking at them as if you're checking in with them, as if you really care how they're doing. Muting, and I'm using these examples particularly as micro interventions from the perspective of someone who's holding a lot of privilege in the room. Mm-hmm. Softening my gestures, making more space. There's just endless numbers of possible things we could do that help to shift what's going on nonverbally so that I'm not taking up as much space and doing a better job nonverbally of sharing the power.
Mm-hmm. Okay, last question, because it's the last thing that I want to make sure we share with people. You also have a somatic first aid kit.
Yes.
So this is like, you're already triggered or whatever, you're not having a good experience.
Yeah.
What's somatic first aid? What do you have in your kit?
Somatic first aid is really about having some strategies to help soothe, center, ground, and settle your body. Taking a breath and follow the exhale, not just the inhale, but really follow the exhale of the breath. When we exhale and we sigh out, we just go, ha. Our minds think, oh, if I'm sighing, I must be in a safe situation. And so it starts to believe it. It's like, oh, okay. The theme of all of these tools, the thing that they all have in common is that they're all things that your body would do if it were okay.
So again, look for pleasure.
Yeah. It's really about tapping into what's happening in your body and then pausing and looking for a different way, another route, another avenue toward pleasure.
That was Rae Johnson, the author of Embodied Activism, Engaging the Body to Cultivate Liberation, Justice, and Authentic Connection.